I'm proud to be a Jew, but that's way too Jewish for me.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is best-selling writer Ann Kirshner, author of The Lady at the OK Corral. We'll also have visits from our two Jewish expert on the international scene, Tom Price, and our maven on Israel, Guy Gelbert. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio@yahoo.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom. One of the most distinctive qualities of Jews everywhere in the world has always been our ability to disagree and yet remain in dialogue. That is, we argue, but stick together. Jewish families are typically loud, contentious, and verbally energetic. Jewish organizations are active, engaged, and often contentious. But we have an ability, after thousands of years of overcoming adversity, to pull together in spite of our many, many differences. Most of the time, anyway. I was reflecting on this fact of Jewish life the last few days. In truth, both in our homes and in our organizational life, we often sound like we're engaged in something closer to courtroom combat than in the loving and harmonious lives we aspire to living. The friction is something typical of every Jewish group I've ever had the privilege of being a part of, and to someone not initiated into the verbal thrust and parry natural to Jews, it can seem that there is real animosity when the situation is quite different than that at heart. It's just that in Jewish life, everyone considers himself or herself to be an expert on, well, everything. And when you get more than one maven in a room at the same time, he or she is each certain to be certain that they are right about everything, or at least whatever it is you are talking about at the moment. The verbal vigor is a great shock to those not raised in loud Jewish homes, and it inevitably leads some people to conclude that Jews are the most difficult, contentious lot ever formed by God. And that's not even counting how it is to be part of a Jewish organization or an organizational leadership, which frequently seem a great deal like herding cats. And I don't mean K-A-T-Z, by the way. Felines. But the real point is not that we Jews can argue. Everybody knows that. It's that in spite of these arguments, we're able to overcome our differences and work together to accomplish truly great things. And that underneath the dispute of the moment, we fully understand that we're not really fully braggus with anyone, that we intend to remain in conversation, dialogue, and community, no matter what we may say in the heat of the moment. I'm not celebrating the contentious quality of Jewish life, but simply noting that it's a fact, and that it also camouflages a more essential unity that undergirds the whole of Jewish community. We might appear not to like each other very much in the moment, but we know that ultimately we are all in this together. We are one people, one large dysfunctional family that may have its challenges and certainly has its conflicts, but that sticks together, particularly when the going gets rough. The Talmud has two famous sayings on this. The first is from the Mishnah, the great code of Jewish law, Pirkei Avot. The ethical greatest hits of that particular text, it says, Kol machloket l'shem shamayim, any argument fought for the sake of heaven will endure, but any argument not fought for the sake of heaven will not last. That means a conflict in which both parties are motivated to find the best course to serve God will create enduring and good results. When we argue in order to determine the truly best course, we're simply trying to figure out how we can really serve God. When we argue to prove how great we ourselves think we are not serving God or helping anyone. And the second great quote from the Talmud is Kol Yisrael Arevim Zeh Bazeh. Each Jew is responsible for every other Jew. At heart, this is the essential truth of what it means to be Jewish. every Jew is responsible for every other Jew. When we remember this teaching, and that first one about arguing for the sake of heaven, well, then our arguments will ultimately lead us to goodness and to unity. Arguments, if you will, to find God. To play us in this morning in a non-argumentative way, although maybe a little bit musically, here's a bit of our pre-Passover preview of Pesach music from the Three Jewish Tenors, a tribute to the great old-time cantor Moshe Osher, a mini-medley of tunes from the Passover Seder, Ki Lo Na'eh and Chad Gadyah, two Hasidic versions of these classic Pesach Seder songs. That was the Three Jewish Tenors, Abe Mizrahi, Meir Finkelstein, and David Propus, singing a mini-medley of Moshe Osher melodies for Passover. That would be some Seder with those three guys at the same time, all of them old friends of mine, by the way. When we come back on Too Jewish this morning, you'll meet our guest, Ann Kirchner, who will tell us who the most famous Jewish woman was in the Old West. She was the common-law wife of Wyatt Earp of O.K. Corral infamy, and there's a lot more about her besides. Find out who she was and what she did when we come back on Too Jewish.
Folks, it's time you experience the Jim Craig difference at Jim Craig Mazda. Get more discounts, more peace of mind, and more selection with two Mazda locations to serve you. The all-new 2014 Mazda 6 is now in stock and ready for immediate delivery. And folks, it's all-new body style. It looks absolutely great. It's priced at only $249 a month. And the 2013 Mazda 3 is now a vent price of just $15,999. More discounts, more peace of mind, and more selection. 10 brands to choose from. That's the power to save. That's the Jim Craig difference.
Parents in Tucson have many choices on where to send their children to school. Consider the best. Consider Tucson Hebrew Academy. Now is the time to secure your spot for the upcoming school year. With a beautiful Foothills K-8 campus and award-winning academics, you owe it to your children to visit THA, Tucson Hebrew Academy, and see what they have to offer. Your child belongs at THA. THA delivers. Low student-teacher ratio supports successful, rigorous academics, and they don't stop there. With an emphasis on the arts, science, and music, music, THA students learn the Hebrew language and are taught Jewish values along with a rigorous academic curriculum. Your child deserves the best. Call 529-3888 to schedule your tour of THA. Financial aid is available. Don't wait. Space is limited. That's 529-3888 or visit www.thaaz.org. We are delighted to welcome the two Jewish art guests this morning, Ann Kirshner. She has a new book out called Lady at the OK Corral. She's the University Dean of Macaulay Honors College at the City University of New York. Began her career as a lecturer in Victorian literature at Princeton University, where she got her PhD. Wrote the very popular Sala's Gift, and is now the author of a book about Josephine Marcus, the common-law wife of Wyatt Earp and one of the more interesting and even controversial figures in the Old West. Good morning and welcome to Two Jewish.
Good morning. Thank you.
So that's quite a journey from your background in Victorian literature to Tombstone, Arizona. Tell us a little bit about how that all happened.
And I could tell you about the stop I took in between at the National Football League, but no, I won't.
Well, I want to hear it. Wait a minute. What was that again?
Well, I did. I also worked for 5 years at the National Football League. But really, it's off the topic, although I guess I could sort of throw an umbrella over my whole career and say that I've always been very interested in history. I've been interested in stories about how women's lives are disrupted by history and what they make of the freedom that they manage to grab despite the disruptions around them. And so Victorian literature was my passion when I was an academic. And then I left academics and was in media and technology for many years, which is where I did the tour of duty at the NFL. And then ended up coming back to academics, but also to a life as a writer, and wrote Sala's Gift, which is the story of my mother's life during the Holocaust and her enslavement in 7 different Nazi camps.
Sala's Gift was very popular. We read it at my book group here. I'm sure book groups all around the country. You're welcome. Book groups all around the country read it. An important Jewish story. What led you to the story of Wyatt Earp and Josephine Marcus and this OK Corral story?
Well, I started reading about Josephine Earp, and at first the idea of a Jewish woman in Tombstone seemed so incongruous that it was almost kind of a bad Jewish joke. How could it be? Like a lot of people, I grew up at a time when Wyatt Earp was everywhere on television. I think young people today can hardly imagine how popular Wyatt Earp was, you know, beyond Justin Bieber. And yet you never heard about women in Tombstone. It was as if these people didn't have wives and mothers and sisters and daughters. So I was drawn to her first just by the unexpected, the novelty of the story. And then I was swept away by the story of this fascinating woman and her famous husband, because most of what we knew about the story turned out not to be true.
We will hear much more about The Lady at the OK Corral, the true story of Josephine Marcus Earp, and talk more with Ann Kirshner when we come back on Two Jewish. Among my most pleasant, at least time-consuming duties, I have the honor of serving as president of the Kohan Memorial Foundation, which celebrates the memories of Rabbi Samuel S. and A. Irma Kohan, my own grandparents. Once a year, the foundation gives a substantial cash award to an individual for outstanding service to Klal Yisrael, the totality of the Jewish people. This service can involve any one of 4 different fields: unity, education and information, creative arts, or rescue. If you know of anyone who might qualify for the 2013 Kohan Award, just visit our website, www.kohanaward.com, C-O-H-O-N, and you'll find the nomination form to submit. And while you're there, you can also learn just who my own grandparents were and who participates in honoring their memory today. That's kohanaward.com, C-O-H-O-N-A-W-A-R-D. It's a good visit.
When you're looking to buy or sell your home, you probably want Tucson's best realtor on your side.
That realtor is Jill Rich. As real estate values change, it's comforting to know that Jill Rich knows Tucson's real estate landscape. She follows the trends. She knows the neighborhoods. She even knows how to help you find financing. But most importantly, Jill cares. It doesn't matter if you're looking for a starter home or a castle. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. For sellers, Jill will develop a personal marketing program that'll sell your house fast. There's no one who knows Tucson real estate better. You can reach Jill Rich at Long Realty's River and Campbell office. Call 349-0174. Jill Rich, providing strong representation in a caring way. Call 349-0174.
Attention, Arizona income taxpayers. You can help send children to our community's Jewish schools without it costing you a dime by directing your tax dollars to JETCO, the Jewish Education Tax Credit Organization. Here's how. State of Arizona allows taxpayers to get a dollar-for-dollar tax credit for payments made to recognized school tuition organizations who provide scholarships for kids in kindergarten through 12th grade to go to qualified private schools. JETCO provides a quality Jewish education to children in need at Congregation Anshe Israel Kindergarten, the Tucson Jewish Community Center Kindergarten, Temple Emmanuel's Kindergarten, and the Tucson Hebrew Academy. If you pay Arizona state income tax and make your contribution to JETCO, you'll get 100% tax credit on your Arizona state income tax return. Join over 750 supporters last year who gave money to JETCO and got it all back in the form of reduced or refunded state income tax. New this year, there's an additional tax credit, the switcher credit. It increases the maximum donation you can make to JETCO to $1,003 for single filers and $2,006 for married couples filing jointly. When we fight every day for the continuity of the Jewish people, take advantage of this great opportunity. JETCO is one way to foster a Jewish identity for our community's kids. Contributions to JETCO have helped hundreds of children receive financial aid in order to get a Jewish education. Call 647-8442, again, 647-8442, or visit JETCO on the web at www.jetco.org. Give the gift of education. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at twojewishradio@yahoo.com or visit our website at twojewishradio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website or download us from there at the Apple iTunes Store as very popular Jewish podcasts. To continue now in our pre-Pesach theme, just 2 weeks and 1 day to go until Seder, here's the classic Siman LeSeder Shel Pesach, the table of contents for the Passover Haggadah, the only such table of contents ever actually sung. That was Kadesh Urchatz from the beginning of the Passover Seder, just 15 days from now.
We welcome our maven on Israel, Guy Gilbert, head of the Weintraub Israel Center. Good morning, Guy. Boker Tov.
Boker Tov, Rabbi.
So we talk about serious and painful subjects often, the challenges Israel faces, nuclear weapons, all kinds of major political issues. Let's talk about the Miss Israel pageant.
Miss Israel. Okay, there is a new Miss Israel, a really beautiful Miss Israel, and I would say that...
They're all beautiful,
they're
by the
all
way.
Beautiful. Yes. They're all beautiful, of course. I hope my wife is not listening. But this time Israel is saying that Ethiopian is beautiful, paraphrasing on the American famous phrase of black is beautiful. And this time, our new Miss Israel is an Ethiopian 21-year-old Taish Ayanawa, I'm not sure I'm pronouncing it right, something like Taish Ayanawa or something of that sort. It's an Ethiopian name. It's
an
very
Amharic
hard
name, probably.
Amharic
right?
name.
Correct.
Taish lives in Netanya in Israel, in the center of Israel. She's 21 years old. She's been an officer in the IDF. She made Aliyah, immigrated to Israel at the age of 12. And she reports that that process was quite challenging for her. She describes the all the process of doing Aliyah to Israel as being very challenging. And it's not surprising because the Aliyah from Ethiopia to many Ethiopian Jews was a very challenging change. First of all, the move itself, whether it was walking through the deserts of Sudan or through other routes and then going on ships getting to Israel, was a very challenging path. Many died along the way, not often talked about, but many people died along the way from Ethiopia to Israel at that time.
Especially when they were coming from Gondar, the more remote regions, all the way to Addis Ababa to get out. It was very challenging.
It was very challenging. And also arriving in Israel, a Western modern society with a whole different culture than the culture that they were used to in Ethiopia, from any layer in life that you might think of, starting with how do someone provide for one's family, how to make food, language, manners, traditions, everything was different coming to Israel. And the shift from Ethiopia to Israel, while on one hand saving that Jewish community from basically dying out of starvation, also introduced very significant challenges. We're talking about a community that came from a
patriarchal system
where the father was the leader.
The father and everything, right?
And suddenly they come to Israel. Suddenly the father is the last one to adapt because it's harder for him to adapt to this society where women and men are equal. The language is different. Finding employment in Israel is very challenging. And it became extremely challenging for the teenagers because the teenagers were the first one to adapt into the Israeli society. But they came from a place where they were expecting the father to put on boundaries, telling them what's right, what's wrong. And suddenly now in Israel, the father is not able to really give them the guidelines. And that created a lot of challenges with integrating the Ethiopian community in Israel. To some degree, I think it's amazing, it's wonderful that Taish won this prize.
It's really Miss Israel prize.
It really symbolizes the beginning of a new era of getting Ethiopian Jews more integrated. We do have Ethiopian in many fields of society, including in the university and in the Knesset and in the army. And here again, another boundary was another glass ceiling was broken. And it's wonderful. It's really, I personally find it, it gives me a reason to smile in the morning.
That's great. I should add one thing. When I was in Israel, 91, 92, I worked at a absorption center, Merkaz Klita, for Ethiopian Jews, who were arriving then in great numbers. And, here an American teaching Ethiopians Hebrew. It's really funny. We weren't that much better in conversational Hebrew. Many of them had never seen a doorknob before. They were very bright. They were energetic. They wanted to learn. But they came from literally a Stone Age culture. They didn't even, maybe Bronze Age. They didn't even have steel or iron in some of the areas. And I remember talking to an Israeli friend, and he said, in a couple of years, everybody's going to think the Ethiopian girls are really beautiful. So now one has been named Miss Israel. It really is part of that acceptance process for every immigrant group in Israel. Thanks, Guy. We'll talk next week.
Thank you very much.
In preparation for Passover, our Jewish poetry slam this morning is on the theme of Exodus, that is, leaving, going outward to a new reality, abandoning all we've known, from Marge Piercy's poem, Magid. The courage to let go of the door, the handle. The courage to shed the familiar walls whose very stains and leaks are comfortable as the little moles of the upper arm. Stains that recall a feast, a child's naughtiness, a loud, blattering storm that slapped the roof hard, pouring through. The courage to abandon graves dug into the hill, the small bones of children, and the brittle bones of the old whose marrow hunger has stolen. The courage to desert the tree planted and only begun to bear. The riverside where promises were shaped. The street where their empty pots were broken. The courage to leave the place whose language you learned as early as your own, whose customs, however dangerous or demeaning, bind you like a halter you have learned to pull inside to move your load. The land fertile with the blood spilled on it, the roads mapped and annotated for survival. The courage to walk out of the pain that is known into the pain that cannot be imagined, mapless, going barefoot without a canteen into the desert. We honor those who let go of everything but freedom, who ran, who revolted, who fought, who became other by saving themselves. That was the poem Magid by Marge Piercy in preparation for Pesach. The first Seder is 2 weeks from tomorrow night, March 25th. When we come back, we'll hear from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, and get the old Jewish joke of the week.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
We're getting closer to Pesach, Passover, the great holiday of freedom, but also another one of those holidays could be summed up in the nine-word recitation of most Jewish holidays. They tried to kill us, we won, let's eat. We seem to focus so much of our energy on all of the dangers and traumas, in part because of our tragic past, without maybe talking very much about what's good or inspirational about Judaism today. Why is that? Where do we go with that?
I think that's a good question, but first let me say that that nine-word summary of the Haggadah would make for a very short Seder.
Yes, everybody would be thrilled.
I never heard it put quite so succinctly, so hats off to you for that. You know, I think you ask a broader question. I mean, it's true that many Jewish holidays like Hanukkah, Pesach, Purim are about episodes of persecution or an attempt to wipe us out or an attempt to wipe Jews off the face of the earth. And obviously those attempts failed either through divine or through human intervention. In the case of Purim, which we celebrated recently, it was Queen Esther who, you know, bravely lived as a hidden Jew in the palace, married to the king. Why our great, great, great ancestors were not more upset about that early example of intermarriage is a good question. But it seems like in that story or in many other stories, we can focus on what they did to us and how we're always the victim and how we have to be vigilant and protect ourselves and watch for signs of oppression or anti-Semitism or discrimination, or what we can do positively to distinguish ourselves. And I think, I don't know if there's a generational difference or not, but I know that among my friends, a lot of people have parents and grandparents who send them emails referring to really obscure and relatively unimportant incidents in a suburb of Paris or a small town in southern Germany where almost randomly a Jewish cemetery is defaced or a Jewish kid is attacked on his way to Hebrew school or whatever it may be. And these things go viral on the internet, and Jews are very vigilant and spend a lot of time pursuing the latest example of the attempts to get us. And one wonders why they don't pursue with equal vigor, energy, and dedication of time opportunities for Jewish learning, opportunities to ask, well, what are the positive things that distinguish us as Jews? What are ways in which we can contribute to the world rather than ways in which we may again become victims? And with the permission of you and your listeners, I'd like to sort of explore that question. Like, why do we make that choice repeatedly and across time and across space in a way that seems almost a self-defeating habit?
It's a great question, and one that all, you know, Jewish leaders, Jewish educators think about. Let's keep going with this next week. Thanks, Tom. We'll talk then.
I look forward to it.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week, Jewish humor your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. Max is crossing the street one day when he's hit by a bus. He's immediately rushed to the hospital and put in intensive care. A few days later, Harry, his best friend, visits. "So, how are things, Max?" Harry asks. "Not good," says Max. "My wife, Leia, visits me 3 times a day." "So what's so bad about that?" says Harry. "Every time she comes," replies Max, "she sits at my bedside and reads to me." "So?" asks Harry. "What does she read?" And Max answers, "My life insurance policy." That was the Old Jewish Joke of the Week, special feature of Two Jewish just for you. You should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. This week we begin reading the middle book of the Torah, Vayikra, Leviticus. Vayikra presents an entirely new challenge to the first-time student of Torah. How do we find relevance in a portion that reflects religious practices that have been obsolete for nearly 2,000 years? The rites of the sacrificial cult that flourished in the days of the Tabernacle of the Wilderness and the Temple in Jerusalem have been replaced for nearly 2 millennia by prayer, study, and a variety of other kinds of religious actions, called mitzvot. Vayikra, however, is a how-to book on korbanot, animal sacrifices. What then can we take from a parsha replete with the ways to slaughter animals, the proper division of the animals' bodies for placing on the altar and the fire, and the different categories of sacrifices so offered? A linguistic hint exists in the word for sacrifice, korban. The Hebrew root for sacrifice actually also means to bring near, karev, as in the Passover Haggadah text, karev yom, bring near the day. When we bring an animal to sacrifice, we're seeking to move close to God, not only to approach the power of divine acceptance, but also to come near to God in every way. We may no longer choose to do this by actually giving up a valuable possession. Remember, giving away livestock was like passing on an SUV for free in its economic meaning to our ancestors. And we may no longer want to kill something to show our love for God. But we can still seek to find powerful and humbling ways to bring ourselves closer to holiness and to the divine. When we pray with sincerity, meditate with meaning, reach out to find the flow of holiness ever present in the world, we can discover the true essence of Vayikra. And then we, like our ancestors of old, may find out that our sacrifice of time, energy, and care can bring us to holiness too. When we come back on Two Jewish, we'll find out about the fascinating Jewish woman who was the common law wife of one of the most famous characters in Western history, Marshal Wyatt Earp of Tombstone, Arizona and the OK Corral. Learn what her role was in the lore and legends of the West when we return on Two Jewish.
Environmental Strategies Incorporated was established in Arizona almost 15 years ago. They're a corporation that's very unique and has distinguished itself as one of the foremost environmental remediation companies in Arizona. Environmental Strategies, Inc. is also a full-service general contractor. The fact that they have 2 divisions affords their clients the opportunity to work with 1 contractor to deal with environmental problems as well as their building and remodeling needs. Environmental Strategies clientele range from single-family homeowners to multi-million-dollar Fortune 500 companies. So, if you're in need of asbestos abatement, mold remediation, or general contracting services, call Environmental Strategies at 884-1114. And, if you wish, ask for Ken Goodman, the president. He'd be more than happy to talk with you about your project. That's Environmental Strategies, 884-1114.
Folks, it's time for you to experience the Jim Click Kia difference. Get more discounts, more peace of mind, and more selection. 2013 Kia Soul is now starting at just $14,988 and only $159 a month. So drive home the fuel-efficient 2013 Kia Rio, special event price only $159 a month. And remember, every Kia comes with a 10-year, 100,000-mile warranty. More discounts, more peace of mind, and more selection, 10 brands to choose from. That's the power to save. That's the Jim Click difference. Kia, the power to surprise.
We continue with our Two Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
American, Canadian, and Australian officials walked out of a meeting with the UN nuclear watchdog agency when the Iranian envoy accused Israel of genocide. Joseph McManus, the U.S. ambassador to the International Atomic Energy Agency, stormed out of the meeting in Vienna last week after Ali Asghar Soltaneh made the accusation, as did Canadian and Australian officials. McManus earlier had accused Iran of deception, defiance, and delay in its dealings with the agency. The meeting came weeks ahead of a renewed effort at talks in Istanbul by the major powers, led by the U.S., to negotiate terms with Iran to make its nuclear program transparent. Western powers and Israel believe Iran is close to being able to manufacture a nuclear weapon. Iran denies this, and Soltaneh repeated these denials, calling the accusations baseless. Some reports say that Iran has dozens of active reactors at work now, trying to stockpile enough enriched uranium to manufacture a bomb. In other news, I don't know if you've been following the Prisoner X story that's been coming out of Israel and Australia in recent weeks. Ever since, the Australian Broadcasting Company ran a story on the identity of that prisoner last month. The core of the tale is that an Australian-born Israeli, Ben Zygir, died in the maximum security prison in Ramla, Israel in 2010, committing suicide by hanging himself with his bedsheet. It turns out that Zygir, who was kept in the prison by Israeli authorities under a false name, thus Prisoner X, was in the Mossad, the Israeli Secret Service, and was being detained for national security reasons. Ben Zygir was from a prominent Melbourne, Australia Jewish family, had made Aliyah to Israel in 1996, taking on the name Ben Alon, served in the IDF, got a law degree, married, had two children, and worked as a lawyer at a prominent firm in Israel. He had traveled frequently back and forth to Australia, but also elsewhere throughout the world, visiting Iran, Syria, and Lebanon on his Australian passport, which he retained. We don't know what exactly Zygir did for the Mossad, but at some point an Australian journalist appeared to have blown his cover. Eventually, he was accused of treason by Israel and arrested. According to some reports, he was facing 20 years in prison for having committed espionage activity against Israel. He was incarcerated in Ramla. We know now that he was held at Unit 15 in Ayalon Prison, a special wing of the prison reserved for only the most dangerous criminals. The cell in which Zygir was held was a special isolation cell originally constructed for Yigal Amir, the assassin of Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin of blessed memory. That cell is isolated from the rest of the wing through a door only prison staff can enter. And while it's possible in that cell to keep a suicide watch in place, there was no indication that Zygir was likely to kill himself. However, in December of 2010, that is apparently what happened. Zygir was 34. This story seems to have legs, as new details keep creeping out. It is apparent that Zygir was a Mossad agent, that he was one of the agents who used an Australian passport for flexibility in his travels for his work. It remains unclear what he actually did that got him arrested, and, to some degree, how he died. But we expect more slow revelations to creep out on this controversial case. A very sad story last week. A young Satmar Hasidic couple from the Williamsburg section of Brooklyn, Nathan and Razi Glauber, were killed in a terrible car accident while on their way to the hospital to deliver their first baby. The child, delivered by cesarean section, survived for a day but then died as well. The livery cab the couple was in was struck by a speeding BMW. Its driver, Julio Acevedo, initially fled the scene but later surrendered to police a couple of days later. Investigators say Acevedo was driving at least 60 miles an hour. He is no stranger to breaking the law. Police say he spent nearly a decade in prison for manslaughter, was arrested for driving under the influence just last month. Other prior arrests included robbery, criminal possessions of a weapon, and reckless endangerment. Apparently, the livery driver, Pedro Nunez de la Cruz, had applied to use his Toyota's livery cab, but the application was still pending when he drove the Glaubers, and the car should not have been sent to pick up passengers, according to the city's Taxi and Limousine Commission. What a mess, and a horrible, sad tragedy. May God bring comfort to those in mourning over this tragic affair among the Satmar. In more entertaining news, in case you think the plagues in the Passover story are all apocryphal legends, last week a swarm of 1 million locusts crossed into Israel from Egypt. Reports say a black cloud of more than 30 million locusts, some estimates ranged as high as 120 million, swarmed over parts of Egypt beginning last weekend, causing millions of dollars worth of damage. There was no word on any frog invasions or total eclipses striking Egypt recently, however. Once the locusts crossed the Sinai, they were concentrated in areas of southern Israel near the border, but sightings were reported throughout the country, including Tel Aviv and the Carmel region of northern Israel. Aerial and ground pesticides were sprayed, and no more swarms are expected to cross the border due to a shift in the wind direction. But the Israelites remain free, locusts or not. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews round the world. We welcome back to Two Jewish our guest this morning, author Ann Kirshner, who wrote Lady at the OK Corral, The True Story of Josephine Marcus Earp, and also earlier wrote Sala's Gift. She's the University Dean at Macaulay Honors College at CUNY. She started her career as a lecturer at Victorian Literature at Princeton, where she got her PhD. And by the way, she also works, as she told us earlier in the show, for the NFL, so worked for the NFL. So a very interesting and colorful career, not quite as colorful nonetheless as that of Josephine Marcus Earp. Tell us a little bit about, you know, Marcus' family was a well-known family, Jewish family. Tell us sort of her mini-biography, if you would.
Well, the Marcus family came from Poland to New York around 1850. Josephine was born around 1860, and then the family went west to San Francisco. And that's where the story gets really interesting. The San Francisco Jewish community in those years was an extremely powerful and wealthy community for the most part. But as is often the case in Jewish communities, there was a wide gulf between the German Jews and the other Jews. And Josephine's family, which was from Poland, they were on the wrong side of the tracks. Josephine's family was poor. They were Yiddish speakers rather than German. Her father was a struggling baker. And Josephine grew up with a real inferiority complex. And she rejected that. You know, she didn't want to be a poor Polish Jew. So she ran away from home. She was 18 years old. She decided she wanted to be an actress and a dancer, and she found her way to the Arizona Territory, where she had a love affair that was unsuccessful, went home again because she turns up in the San Francisco census, and then that same lover comes back and brings her to Tombstone. So we have the story here of Jewish immigration, of Jewish success in San Francisco, but also Jewish intolerance towards other Jews, because there was this great sociological and economic divide.
Tombstone seems like a logical place to attract miners and marshals and all of the typical, I don't know, riffraff of the Old West. It was one of the really spectacular boom towns that eventually died back, of course. But for a Jewish girl to go there, was it just in search, you know, she went with this guy, which you read about in the book a little bit. You know, that must have been just such an incongruous place for her.
Well, it was. Tombstone was bigger than Tucson, if you can believe that. And if you go to both places today, it is hard to believe that. But the whole Arizona Territory was greatly in need of entertainment. And so it was the years of the pinafore craze. And every town had its own pinafore theater. Josephine joined a traveling troupe that went throughout the Arizona Territory. So she left with that troupe from San Francisco and then did this tour of duty in the Arizona Territory, which is where she caught the eye of Sheriff Johnny Bean. So, you know, running away from home was the first act. She didn't go completely to Tombstone on her own. She went as part of this traveling troupe.
When she got there, as you mentioned, she hooked up with Sheriff Johnny Behan, who, was he married at the time? He had another girlfriend. He was certainly a womanizer.
Well, he was certainly a womanizer. He had actually gotten a divorce, and it was a public, very ugly divorce because he was consorting with a prostitute. It was a nasty story, a really nasty story. He fell in love with Josephine, but when he brought her to Tombstone and she lived openly as Mrs. Behan, what she didn't know was that, you know, Johnny Behan had a girl in every boomtown and certainly wasn't going to be settling down with Josephine. So she eventually left him. The story goes that she caught him in bed with another woman, but we don't actually know that for sure. And then started an affair with Wyatt Earp. And we think we know something about the gunfight, the 1881 gunfight at the OK Corral. And a lot of what we know is about the politics and the power and the money that divided the two camps. And all of that is true. But what we didn't know was that Josephine had a lover on both sides, because Johnny Behan had been her lover, and he was allied with the cowboy and rustler faction. And on the other side was handsome Wyatt Earp and his brothers and Doc Holliday. So that confrontation, which has so much become a part of our lexicon, you know, you hear about the gunfight at the OK Corral and everything from congressional showdowns to Wall Street battles to NBA games, you know, it's compared, everything is compared to the OK Corral. Well, in fact, the OK Corral was in part about jealousy and revenge. It was a love triangle with this incredibly sexy, gutsy broad, Josephine Marcus, right in the middle.
Jewish broad from from San Francisco. She was with Behan, and then, so how did that, she caught Behan or somehow or other broke up with him and started dating Wyatt Earp. Wyatt had a common law wife from before who had a laudanum problem?
Yes. So Wyatt Earp and his brothers arrived in Tombstone in 1879, and they were there with their common law wives, which was quite common, so to speak, at the frontier. There wasn't always a judge or a clergyman to marry you, and so it was quite a common practice. Wyatt's wife was named Mattie Blaylock, and Mattie was a very passive woman, not terribly attractive, but the Earp wives were a very tight-knit community. When Wyatt took up with Josephine, you know, of course, it was a big secret at the time. It was not known in Tombstone. And after the gunfight, and this is the only act of cowardice that I think I ever discovered about Wyatt Earp, he actually sent Mattie, his common-law wife, back to his parents in California to stay with them and stay out of harm's way while he went off on the vendetta ride. He never, of course, sent for Mattie again. He left her there with his parents to figure out eventually that Wyatt was not coming back to her. And that is the main skeleton in the closet that Josephine spent really her entire life trying to suppress. Because when Mattie figured out that Wyatt was not coming back to her, she did eventually leave his parents. Who wouldn't? And it was pretty hard for a woman to support herself in those days. And she became a drug addict and a prostitute and eventually committed suicide and told everybody she could that it was Wyatt Earp who had done this to her. That is, there were many secrets that Josephine and Wyatt had rattling around in their past, but that was really the worst one, Josephine's sense of guilt over what had happened to Wyatt's previous wife.
So after Wyatt Earp does, first of all, the shootout at the OK Corral, and then his brother is shot by the cowboy faction, and then he goes on the vendetta ride, and Josephine goes back to San Francisco briefly, and then, whether it's expected or not, she ends up really being with Wyatt for the rest of his life, and it's a colorful life.
Wyatt sweeps her up in San Francisco in around 1882, and for the next almost 50 years, they traveled mostly in the West, but they did They did go to Chicago together. That's probably as far east as they went. And it was a life of nonstop adventure. And I think that was one of the things that surprised me, was that grown-ups could lead this Peter Pan existence where they never had a permanent home, they never knew where their next dollar was going to come from, they made fortunes, they lost fortunes, and they were just like two children, whether they were living in a fancy hotel or out in the California desert. It was a life of nonstop adventure.
Which included Alaska, Nome, the big gold rush there, the Klondike gold rush?
I think Alaska, if I'm allowed to say, I think that's kind of my favorite time of their life, because
you are allowed to say
Nome, Alaska is as out of the way place as you can imagine. I've been there. It's not easy to get to, and it's really is incredibly remote. But in the summer of 1900, Nome, Alaska was one of the most well-known, popular, interesting places on Earth, because gold had not only been discovered, it had been discovered on the public beaches, the beaches along the Bering Sea in Nome, Alaska. And so everybody from the West was trying to get there. So that's one of the most exciting parts of their lives. But you know, it's only one, because after that they ended up in Hollywood and in the birth of the film industry, which was another very exciting time in their life.
It is sort of amazing. I mean, here they are traveling back lots, talking to, you know, Jewish movie producers. They didn't seem to think so much of Josephine, though, did they?
No. I mean, Josephine's job was to protect Wyatt, and she was as fierce about that as you can imagine. There's no modern publicist who can hold a candle to Josephine. She wanted to make sure that Wyatt's image was, you know, firmly the guy with the white hat, and all of this other stuff about Wyatt being a gambler and a pimp and a saloon keeper, all of which was true. You know, she wanted to keep all of that out of the papers and out of the movies. So you can imagine how popular she was on a movie set. She was thrown off at least one 20th Century Fox and made herself very unpopular on a few others.
You know, Wyatt Earp, when you were growing up, he was the guy with the white hat. But of course, the story is not only those activities, but really he was kind of a vigilante with a badge a lot of the time, wasn't he?
He was. And that, I think, is part of the enduring interest in Wyatt Earp. He's really a very ambiguous figure. Law and order, yes. But when he feels that justice is impossible in the conventional sense of the courts, he takes the law into his own hands. And, you know, who among us hasn't been struck by some incredible injustice where, you know, we're swept away by the sense that we have to right the wrong? And so I think it's that sense of Wyatt Earp as avenging angel, devil, a little bit of both, that continues to keep us so enthralled.
They never had kids together. Did she have any children that we don't know about?
Well, you know, I mean, the one thing, a historian has to be humble. And so will there be anything that I haven't found out about? I am absolutely sure that there will be. As far as I can tell, they never had any children. Josephine apparently had several miscarriages. She was a devoted aunt. She loved children. And so did Wyatt. And so I have no doubt that had they been able to have children, they would have done so. So who knows? In years to come, will somebody step out of the shadows and declare himself, herself to be their offspring? It's possible. I was in touch. I mean, I did a lot of years of research on this book, and I was in touch with the closest living relatives for Josephine Earp. I've even met some of Wyatt Earp's relatives as well, and I learned a lot from them. I was able to meet people who knew her, And that was a tremendous thrill.
Boy, it's a great story. Lady at the OK Corral, the true story of Josephine Marcus Earp. I want to thank Ann Kirchner for a great visit here on Too Jewish.
Thank you. I look forward to seeing you in Tucson.
And you can find that book anywhere. And, you know, you should read it if you live in Tucson or have been through Tucson or want to go to Tombstone or just want a great Western story. Thanks so much.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. When we come back, we'll hear about next week's guest. Get a final musical play out on Too Jewish.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday at 9 o'clock. Our guest will be Dylan Williams, the chief lobbyist for J Street. Our playout this morning comes from a wonderful new Jewish band called Jump Babylon, formed in Montreal from a previous new Jewish music scene klezmer band called Streibel. Their style is kind of a blend of ska, reggae, and klezmer, believe it or not, with fat horns. This one is called Zion is Not a Four-Letter Word. My friends, may you be blessed with a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace.
Looking over the hills as the red sun sets, a beautiful crown for the king of capitals. This day has ended, a new one begins. As people fill the streets and crowd the city square, different colors speak in different languages. Gathered together from all four corners, from the east to the western wall, to the dance hall and study hall, markets, bus stops, line up, stand up, 'cause we